Our speaker is Elizabeth from the Early Sobriety Group in Allentown. Please welcome Elizabeth.
My name's Elizabeth Batches. I'm a recovered alcoholic.
Hi, Elizabeth.
It's good to see everybody out on a snowy night. I'm never sure really where to begin. I'll start with this. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. For whatever reason, I was tailor-made for this program. I walked into my first meeting and they said, here's a book that tells you every answer you have for every problem you'll ever have from here on out, and I was so relieved. I didn't have to figure it out anymore. I had a place to look it up. It was just a perfect fit for me. And it was the first place that I felt like I had a perfect fit. I was born with a pitchfork in one hand and a silver spoon in the other. My mother's parents were North Dakota farmers, and my father's family was old Detroit car money. So I did not know where I fit, and I didn't feel like I fit in either place, and spent pretty much equal time in both places. And I said my ideal place to be would be about a 50-acre farm in the middle of New York City. You know, that'd be a place for me. I love the city, but I love the farm, too, at the same time. So, you know, any major city would be fine. Until about 5 years ago, almost 5 years ago now, I lived mostly in Detroit most of my life. I was born in Pittsburgh, but raised mostly in the Detroit area. When I got sober, I was a Stepford wife, pretty much coasting on whatever I could to keep the noise in my head down. And country club and fancy house and fancy clothes and fancy cars, and I was absolutely dying inside. Anybody looking from the outside thought my life looked perfect, and I was ready to kill myself. Actually, that's what led me to AA, was trying to kill myself, and didn't work, obviously. I'm still here. I started drinking pretty early, about 12, actively seeking it out. I guess I actually started drinking as an infant. My mother put it in my formula because I guess I was pretty colicky. I was always pretty fussy. And I wasn't until I was about 9 years sober that I found out that my mother had blamed herself all along for my alcoholism when I told her that I was an alcoholic. And I just felt horrible for her, and, you know, I'm not an alcoholic because of where I came from, where I lived, who my parents are, who my parents weren't, who my friends were, who they weren't. None of those things had, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with ethnicity, gender, none of that. That is not why I'm an alcoholic. And frankly, I don't care why I'm an alcoholic. It doesn't matter where the problem came from. I know where to find the solution now. You know, that's all that really mattered. And I'm going to kind of bounce back and forth. I don't do well with the whole chronology because I'm just going to keep coming back to where I am now. So, you know, telling my mother was just, when I first told her I was going to AA, she said, oh, honey, you're not an alcoholic. You just drank too much occasionally, you know. But she couldn't face it herself. She thought it was her fault. And it took a long, long time. You know, we often think that our families are unhappy with us because of what we did, and what I have come to understand, I've been sober just a little over 16 years. January 1st, 1993 was my last drink. The more I understand about this, the more and more I know this is absolutely nothing to do with me. My sobriety is not about me at all. It has nothing to do with me. It's about me being less of a ripple in the world which my stone hits the pond. To make life easier for other people, because all I did was just wreak havoc, you know, in one way or another. I think about my first fourth step quite frequently because it was, had pretty eventful, I was going to the meetings about 9 months, sober about 9 months, and there was a Joe and Charlie big book study that was going to be in Detroit. Sent my check in, and they sent it back. It was already full, and I thought, oh, well, dodge that bullet, because I didn't really want to go. I would do what my sponsor told me to do, and I appeared to be willing, and there was a part of me that was, but mostly I was terrified to not do what she told me to do, and so I did it even though I wasn't real excited about it. So I made the mistake of telling someone how thrilled I was that I didn't have to go to the Joe and Charlie thing, And they found one really close by in London, Ontario. There are two problems with that. I had to cross a river to get there. And I don't drive through tunnels, and I don't drive over bridges. At least then I didn't. And I also had never been anywhere without my husband or my kids in over 13 years. So I was also a little codependent. And so, you know, I had, everything about me was about everybody else. And so I went to this Joe and Charlie thing, and this, as soon as I sent that check in the mail for that, I knew that I was going to be able to get there. You know, so I took the tunnel there, which was less scary to me than the bridge. And they do the, in Ontario there, they did things a little bit differently in the Joe and Charlie thing. You were assigned a study partner, but right off the bat, and my study partner was a tugboat captain. It's like this freshwater, salty dog, and it's like, oh, I did not want to tell this guy anything that was on my footstep. I didn't know who he was. He lived on a tugboat, for crying out loud. You know, I did not want to talk to him at all. And, you know, I just learned that, you know, it's just one drunk talking to another. But when I was in my hotel room that night, the first time ever wanting to find a Bible, because the name of his name is Captain John, and the name of his boat was Matthew 14:30. Because I asked him, what is the name of your boat? And Matthew 14:30. So I'm furiously back in the hotel room. First time ever, I cannot find a Gideon Bible. First time I want a Bible, no Bible. And if you want to find out what Matthew 14:30 is, you'll have to find your own Bible. And I just loved that. And when I was writing down my fear list, the first thing that I wrote down was the bridges. And the minute I wrote down bridges, I knew I was going to be able to drive across this scary-ass bridge from Ontario over into Michigan on my way home. The Blue Water Bridge is way high and very scary. And I've been driving across bridges ever since and through tunnels. And I just did that Chesapeake Bay, Virginia, 17 miles. That was so cool. That was so cool. You know, you have no idea the kind of freedom that you get from getting rid of those things. And, you know, and it was just removed for me. You know, I didn't. One of the things that my sponsor reminded me that, you know, when the defects of character come up and when I want them removed, to look at that prayer carefully, the seven-step prayer, it asks God, we ask God to remove that which stands in his way of my being useful, not what stands in my way. So I might still appear to be an idiot in many respects of my life, but apparently it's to teach someone else something or to teach me something. You know, but, it, you know, it's, I don't get to pick and choose what gets removed. Yeah, if I've got bad habits like being late, not having decent table manners, you know, not paying my bills on time, that's not a character defect. That's just lazy, you know, and that's inconsiderate. It's not a character defect. But, you know, it's just, I never knew when that thing was going to, how those things were going to get removed. But the thing that was so funny about the bridge for me was one of my huge resentments was my ex-husband. We were driving to North Dakota with the kids, and it was my turn to drive. He'd already driven across the Mackinac Bridge, and 5 miles long. No way I was driving that one. And we came to this new bridge in where Michigan, you cross over from Michigan into Wisconsin, and it was a brand-new, huge thing. And I was driving. I pulled over. I said, I can't do this. He was so annoyed with me. And he, obviously, you know, I can't blame the guy. You know, 12 years of not, you know, always having to stop any time it came to a bridge if I was driving is ridiculous. But that's how much it controlled me. And I love that example because it's just one thing that chains us, and you don't need to be chained by any of your fears. But as I was going around one side of the car, he just slid across and took off without me. And he kept going. And I had to make arrangements to get a bus and get the rest of the way to North Dakota to my grandparents. And you can imagine how angry I was. And it wasn't until several years later when working on my fifth step with my sponsor, and she made me see that how, you know, talks about in her book, can we place ourselves in a position to later be hurt, you know, based decisions based on self. Oh, yeah, that was a huge decision based on self, a ridiculous, irrational fear. You know, there's no guarantee that nothing's going to happen, and I was constantly, fear just absolutely ruled my life entirely. I made every decision based on fear. You know, for me, alcohol was my solution. It was my answer to that fear, that constant gnawing, shaking, eating up inside of me all the time. It was how I could go to school. It was how I could participate in sports. It was how I could just kind of show up for life. I was pretty much drinking something most every day from about age 12 until I graduated from college. And there were periods of that which were just really, really insane, really bad. And, you know, I could have gotten myself in some serious trouble and, you know, always finding myself in the wrong places with the wrong people, you know, at the wrong time. And I've had a pretty charmed existence in a lot of ways, some extraordinary, extraordinary opportunities. And I always managed to tarnish them with alcohol. Somehow or another, if I didn't completely ruin the experience, it was not only tainted for me, but I would ruin someone else's memory of the experience because of my having to constantly, you know, have everything revolved around Elizabeth's fears, you know, the whole family and, you know, and anybody that I was in a relationship with. I'm also, I didn't tell you this, I'm a serial monogamist. I get married a lot. I don't know how to date. Yeah, I'm on husband number 3. I've been married to him the longest of anybody, and we will be married 15 years in May. I did meet him in the rooms. We did everything our sponsors told us not to do. and somehow, miraculously, we have survived. And it actually isn't miraculous. It's because we knew in the relationship that it couldn't be just the two of us, that that would just be horrible, that it had to be, you know, it had to be our own holy trinity, Mark, me, and God. I mean, and it had to be God first, and that's the only way I could ever do it. And, you know, I destroyed 2 other relationships, and it took me a long time to see who was the common denominator, because I was always pointing the finger, you know, if you were married to him, you know, if he didn't, you know, da-da-da-da-da. Who's the common denominator in all these relationships? Both my ex-husbands remarried shortly after they, you know, got rid of me, and they've stayed married to those people all ever since then. So I don't think that they're the problem. I have a feeling I was the problem. But I, you know, I would constantly have periods in my life when, you know, the alcohol would get me into trouble, and then I'd straighten up for a while, and that's what college was that way. One semester I'd just crash and burn. I'd barely get a 1.2 and just be drunk all the time. And then the next semester I wouldn't drink anything and I'd get straight A's. You know, it was just, I couldn't seem to find any kind of a balance. It wasn't until I got here that I realized that I was controlling my drinking. I had no idea what all that stuff was. I just noticed that as I got older, I couldn't drink gin anymore. And then it got to the place like I just couldn't drink whiskey anymore. And then I, you know, finally got to the place where I couldn't drink enough of anything to get me where I needed to go. And that was probably the worst. But about 4 years before I got sober, I'd been going to Al-Anon forever. Somehow I missed everything about God. I saw nothing about the steps. I don't know how I went to 2 or 3 Al-Anon meetings a week and missed it all, but I did. It's probably because I was going to the bar afterwards. That may have had something to do with it. And this wonderful man in Al-Anon, Marty, he'd been going to Al-Anon for 44 years. He said to me, he says, you know, Elizabeth, you might be in the wrong room. You probably need that room down the hall. A meeting at the same time as the Al-Anon meeting. Oh, I was mad. So, of course, I quit going to Al-Anon. And you know, it made me mad. And I did not go to the room down the hall. I did, however, quit drinking alcohol. But I was an absolute mess. You know, in the book it describes the alcoholic without recovery but sober, restless, irritable, and discontent, you know, and then turn the volume way up, and that was me. And so I sought other methods of calming down my insides. And when I first got sober, my sponsor had me go to every single doctor I had seen to get me prescriptions and made me take all of those folders to a new doctor. She told me to go see some addiction guy, and I handed him to him. He said, how long you been sober? And I think it was maybe about 18 or 19 days at that point. He says, you know, I think you have a chance. You know, and I didn't know what he was talking about or what kind of a crystal ball he had, but Margo figured it was because I was willing to go and collect these records and show somebody exactly what I was about, what I'd been doing, and playing this game to get prescriptions for, because that's what I use in place of alcohol. Well, then my little Cinderella world exploded, and had a horrible thing that just split the whole family apart, pretty much, and it didn't have anything to do with alcohol. Alcohol, just about, probably that's when it started to kill me. And the family split off. I was kind of left by myself. My husband's family wouldn't have anything to do with me because of my family, and my family rallied around one person and kind of left me out. And so I, you know, we, it was a, I'm going to say it, it's just easier than dancing around it. A family member sexually molested my kids, and I took this person to court. I reported him to the police, and my family, mostly my brothers, felt that we should have dealt with it in the family, that I shouldn't have gone to court. I did not want my kids to grow up and think that their mother hadn't done absolutely everything possible to protect them and to take care of them. So I went to the police. And I had worked with the police. I was a 911 operator for the city of Detroit for quite a while. So I knew the guys, and you know, I knew that's what had to be done. It was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done, harder than getting sober. That was the hardest thing to do, was turn a family member in. And when we went to court, he got 10 days served and probation. That was it. And he pled no contest, so it didn't even leave my kids a civil option to sue him when they became adults. And I think that was the thing that just pushed me over the edge. And so we went to have lunch after court, and I kind of came to, sitting at the table, and there were two bottles of Stroh's and an empty shot glass, and I knew I was done. I had a pair of shorts. That's what we call it. That's how you order Stroh's in Detroit. You order a pair of shorts, you know, two bottles, because by the time the bartender gets back down to the other end, you're going to be done with the first one, and you're going to have to call him back again. So you don't want to inconvenience the bartender, so you order a pair of shorts. And, you know, heaven forbid we inconvenience the bartender. And, you know, and that was September 10th, 1992. And I spent literally every day from then until January 1st of 93 trying not to drink. It was the first time ever that I was not able to put it down when I needed to or wanted to. Terrified me. First time ever I'm mixing prescription medication with alcohol. I always had done one or the other. Scared the hell out of me. Hospitalized twice, alcohol poisoning. Scared the hell out of me. No one once said, you might have a drinking problem. Nobody once said to me, maybe you should go to AA. Nobody said a word. And which should have been a clue for me. But I guess I was in too much of a fog to recognize it. I was taking my kids to school, still drunk from the night before. Wasn't getting dressed at all during the day. I was going, you know, days on end. I was trying to do the shower and get dressed thing 5 o'clock in the afternoon before the husband came home, so he wouldn't know that I was, you know, in pukey pajamas all day. You know, it just didn't work. We're just not pretty, and it just didn't work. I managed to be sober on the 23rd of December, but ruined Christmas. And, you know, I don't even want to see the pictures from that Christmas. It was horrible. And every year we always had a big Rose Bowl party. And we had season tickets to Wolverines for, I don't know, 16 years. And my brother was with the team, so we had tickets. And when he had been in college, so we had tickets. And they actually won. They hadn't won a Rose Bowl in forever. And they actually won, and we got the champagne out. And I had this little paper. I never drank champagne. Tequila was what I wanted. You know, Jack Daniels is what I wanted. Southern Comfort was what I wanted. Not because I liked those things. Those were the only things that took me where I needed to go. I never could drink like a lady. And so I had this little dinky paper cup of champagne, and I knew immediately as soon as I drank, I said, what have you done? What have you done? Because I finally managed again to not drink for about a day. And I left a house full of guests and went to bed, because I was so afraid that if I didn't do that, I was going to be off to the races again. And, of course, I didn't go to meetings for about 2 more weeks. Finally dragged myself into AA. The day that I woke up, it was around the 20th or so of January, I knew without a shadow of a doubt, you know, we talk about those moments of clarity, that if I did not drink that day, I was going to die. And if I didn't die that day, I was going to drink again, and I was never going to be able to get sober. I absolutely believed that with every fiber of my being. I went and got my hair done, got my nails done, went to Ann Taylor, bought a brand new outfit, it wasn't even on sale. You know, I was just crazy. I was going to leave a good-looking corpse. I only weighed about 104 pounds, significantly less than what I weigh now. And I'm not exactly a huge person now. So I was just anorexically thin. It was just awful. And I lived right near Lake St. Clair, and I was a sailor, so I knew where there were some deeper spots in the lake. Lake St. Clair is really just a widening of the Detroit River. It's not really a lake. It's really shallow. They have to dredge for the freighters, but most everywhere else is only about 6 or 8 feet deep. So it's not really a good place to plunge your car. But there was a spot that I knew I could, and I had a van conversion, and I popped out the back windows, and I scoped out my site a couple times during the day where I was going to go, and put the kids to bed, told my husband I was going to buy milk, and went to my spot. Well, the wind had shifted, and all this ice had walked right up the side of the road. It was like this great big wall of ice. There was no way I was getting my car, a van, through that and into the lake. I sat down in the snow and sobbed and banged on the snow, "God damn it, why won't you let me die?" And then I remembered it was Tuesday night, and there was an Al-Anon meeting about 3 blocks from where I was, and right down the hall from that Al-Anon meeting was an AA meeting. But what the heck, I'll try it. And I got there, I was early, I'm always early, and it was the first time ever my sponsor was early to a meeting. She has never been on time to one since, let alone early. The one and only time she was early. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being there that day. And I sat down in the seat. In Detroit, they don't have meetings where everybody has the same meeting. They have tables where there are 8 to 12 people to a table. So you have to learn to pick your table early on to get what you need for so. Because you might be at the do the first step for a year, gonna die, kill myself table, or you might be sitting at the half measures table when they're only talking about football and, you know, doing point spreads, whatever it is you do with picking the squares and all that nonsense. Or you might be in the old timers room that if you aren't at least 70 years old, they won't let you sit there. Or if you're newly sober, you're not allowed to sit at the big book table. Does this make sense to anybody? Then to me. But I sat down at the Tuesday night asshole table. I did. That's where I sat, absolutely where I belonged. We were the Tuesday night assholes, and it was an absolutely perfect fit. It was a group of people who were serious about getting sober but didn't take themselves too seriously. We actually eventually had T-shirts made, you know, Tuesday night asshole table. It was fun. So I sat down in this seat, and earlier that day, I had gone to local funeral home for a viewing for a longtime family friend, and there were just tons of people there. And so I was still, you know, I was dressed in my fancy outfit, and all these people started coming down the hall wearing black, like they'd, and they had all just been at Charlie's funeral. Well, it turns out this man I had known my entire life had been sober forever. I did not know he was an Alcoholics Anonymous. And I guess I sat in his chair. And Margo leaned over to me, because somebody says, "You can't sit there, that's Charlie's chair." And she leaned over to me, she says, "Don't ever let anybody chase you out of your seat." I'm like, okay, what's going on here? She said to me, she says, "I truly believe that, you know, Charlie's passing was to make room for you." And she said, "I think she believes still that there are only so many seats in Alcoholics Anonymous." Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but it was enough for me. And she handed me a book that night, which I still carry to meetings, and I take it every meeting I go to, and this is the book that she gave me, my first big book. And I have others since. I have one by every phone. I keep one at work. You know, they're just everywhere. And the extra one in the trunk to give away. But she gave me this big book, and, you know, the format was, if you were new, you were supposed to go to the first step table. And I was terrified to get up and move from my seat because it was hard enough to walk into that room, and I was afraid if I got up and moved to the table next door, which was the first step table, that I would just end up leaving. And she says, "Don't worry about it. We don't need that. We'll, you know, you can just stay right where you are." And I was so grateful for that. And Then I heard all this horror stories of stuff. I hadn't had a DUI, hadn't been to jail, well, once in high school. All these things that I didn't think I had done, and so I didn't think that I qualified. I felt so good when I got there and felt welcome, but by the time the meeting was over, I was sure that they weren't going to let me stay, that I wasn't enough of an alcoholic. And I think Margot saw something in my eyes. She knew I was thinking about running, and the first thing she said, "Do you have a car?" I said, "Yes." She said, "Do you have a valid driver's license?" She emphasized the valid. And, "Yes, I do." She said, "Well, can you pick me up for a meeting tomorrow at 4:30? "Oh, I don't know if I can. I had a hard time getting out tonight." She said, "Well, where are you going?" I said, "Oh, to kill myself." She says, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." And I said, "Oh," but she says, "Well, how did you get out of the house? What was your excuse?" I said, "I was going to get milk." She said, "Whatever you do, buy milk on your way home." And, he never asked me why it took me from 7:30 until about 10:30 that night to buy a gallon of milk, but never asked. So, and she gave me this big book, and she said, "Read the first three pages and then call me and we'll talk about it." She said she didn't care what time it was. Just call her and we would talk about what I'd read. And she said, "Start with the very beginning, with the title page." She said, don't go into the end. And said, "But whatever you do, do not read the story in the back, Freedom from Bondage. You're not ready for that." So, that's what I did. I read the book, Freedom from Bondage, it just seems, I thought I was a fairly intelligent person. I was amazed at how easily I could be manipulated. I'm just an idiot savant for this program. So I read Freedom from Bondage, and the woman talked about loving men one man at a time. I identify with this babe, and that hooked me. So I had picked up Margot the next day at 4:30. We went to the laundromat. We stopped at the library. We went to the grocery store. We went back and vacuumed her apartment. I'm like, "Oh my God, what is going on here?" And we ended up getting something to eat. We went to the meeting. We drove some people home. We went for coffee. Picked me up the next day. And we did the same kind of thing again. Well, what I'm discovering in all this, and it took me a few days to realize it, I'm getting to the grocery store now. I'm getting my own errands run because I'm running her around. I'm getting my own. I hadn't done anything in months. And it took me a couple of weeks before I suddenly realized I was starting to get cocky. 2 weeks sober, I was starting to get real cocky. And I said to a friend of mine who I used to drink with and had disappeared off the face of the earth about 9 months before, found him in AA, I said, "Moose, how was Margot getting the meetings before I got here? She doesn't have a car. What was she doing?" He says, "You idiot. She's been getting you to meetings." "Oh, yeah, she was getting me to meetings. I was picking her up, but she was getting me to meetings." And, and that's pretty much, how I've done this whole thing. And and that's the way it's been. And my sponsors have, Margot was my first sponsor, and she was my sponsor for the first year. And sadly, she decided that near beer would be okay. And she is not sober and has not been since then, but is still a dear friend. And I had to get a new sponsor. And she was pretty much the same way. They were about action. And I was told, too, that this program is very simple. It's about trusting God, cleaning house, and change everything. Everything. But part of all don't I understand. Everything. And my sponsor told me, I always wore my watch on my left hand. She said, "Start wearing it on your right hand to remind yourself every day that you've chosen to change everything." And, of course, I haven't changed everything, but I'm willing to change a little bit more every day, and that's all I can hope for. I am human. I obviously am not going to change everything, I knew I was powerless over alcohol, and I knew my life was unmanageable. I just didn't understand what unmanageability meant. I thought manageability meant if I was paying my bills on time, I was showing up for appointments, then my life was manageable. I didn't have anything to do with it. I was running around on self-will. I had no rudder. I had no wind in my sails. I needed a higher power, and I didn't want anything to do with God. My father was a Presbyterian minister, and so on top of all the other stuff, being a PK, that was really fun. And we lived in a Jewish neighborhood in Detroit, and I did not know until I was in seventh grade that you couldn't be a Jewish Presbyterian. because we went to Temple with our friends on Saturday, and they came with us to youth group on Sunday. They weren't allowed to go to our church services, but they were allowed to go to the youth group. It was about the only social activity that, you know, that we had. So I had no idea you couldn't be a Jewish Presbyterian. So I was pretty confused theologically, as you can imagine. And fortunately, somebody told me that it wasn't about religion at all, and it didn't matter what my theology was, that it was simply about God, and that I needed to find a way to get to God if I wanted to save my life. And that was tough to do, but I just kept working at it and finding some way to find a bit of God. And you know, it was that second meeting that I went to. You know, Margot asked me, you know, do you think that we can help you? Do you think Alcoholics Anonymous can help you? I said, oh, absolutely. She's good. Get on your knees. I'm like, what? She said, you've just taken the second step on your knees into your third step, and we did our third step prayers. As soon as you would, and I had to. Yeah, but I stalled for months then doing that four-step, and I got crazier and crazier and crazier. And it wasn't until I went to that Joe and Charlie weekend in September that I finally did my four-step. And I couldn't wait to drive home from there and do my fifth step with her. And I've been doing inventories ever since. My sponsor, Stacy, who I got after Margo, has required me to do some sort of an inventory every year. She gives me my assignment Thanksgiving. We always do the fifth step over Christmas, because otherwise she won't recognize my anniversary. I hope I didn't break her. So, you know, it's inventory has been hugely important to me, and it's amazing where I go with the inventory. You know, the first one was just a rough and dirty one, but it helped me find out that I could do it and it wouldn't be horrible, and that I would live through it and see what some of my grosser handicaps were, like absolutely filled with fear and as a result completely self-driven, you know, constantly in everybody else's way out of my own self-centered fear. And of course out of that comes dishonesty, everything, you know, all the stuff that comes with it, you know, in that fourth column. And you know, to be able to share that with somebody, and I remember working on it, and my sponsor was busy working on her PhD, and our schedules didn't work very well sometimes, and I had to sit with my fourth step for a couple of weeks before I could do the second one that I did with my second sponsor, Stacy. And I remember something in the middle of the night, and I was absolutely horrified. I hadn't made it on my list. I didn't even think about putting it on my list, and it was probably about the only time I ever felt the need to call a sponsor in the middle of the night, because I suddenly realized this huge lie that I had told. I had believed this so much, and I had made so many decisions based on it, that I was just horrified. And so I called her and talked to her about it. And you know, then when a few days later, when we were doing the inventory, the fifth step, she said, before we get started, she says, we're not even going to bother with the rest of the stuff until we get the take it to the grave secret out of the way. She says, that's where we're going to start. And everything else will be easy after that. And I realized that my take it to the grave secret was the thing I had talked to her about the other night. And it just made everything else so much easier. It made it so much easier for me to look at what was going on inside of me. You know, that these things were things that I did. They weren't who I was. That the idea was to clear this stuff away so that I could be the person that God wanted me to be. So that I could be put in that position to, you know, be of maximum service. You know, I love this stuff in the book because it gives me a purpose. It gives me a reason for being on the planet. It makes it possible for me to do a job now that if somebody had told me 20 years ago I'd be doing, I'd say, you are out of your mind. I will never work Saturdays. I will never work Sundays. I will not mix paint. Are you kidding me? Do you know who I am? You know, that would have been the obnoxious attitude that I would have had, because I was just ridiculously spoiled, rotten, just not nice. And, you know, to be able to, you know, it says Sherwin Williams on my shirt, but I don't work for Sherwin Williams. I don't. And Sherwin Williams might be on my paycheck, but it's not their money. And it's not mine either. It's God's. I drive God's car. You know, I use God's furniture. I live in God's house. I work for God at Sherwin Williams. You know, I don't think God cares what kind of job I have, as long as what I'm doing, I do in service to God. And it may sound corny and goofy, but that's me. Kind of ask anybody I sponsor, and I'm corny and I'm goofy. And I want to have fun I don't want to be sober and miserable. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love my life. I have not had typical trajectory that most people in recovery seem to have. Mostly what I watched is people get stuff back, you know, get jobs back, get husbands or wives back and kids back and get the bigger house and get the better job and get the better clothes. And my trajectory has been completely the opposite. I went from the diamonds and the Cadillac and the country club and all that other nonsense to living in a mobile home park in Pennsylvania. Who would have thought? Never would have thought. And I've never been happier. Never been happier. You know, and that's one of the things our book talks about is, you know, are we able to match calamity with serenity? You know, I'm not, obviously things are going to be difficult in our lives, but how do I handle it? You know, that's the thing that's important. And, you know, sometimes I get worn down and I get tired and I cry and whine to my sponsor and she reminds me that it must just get to be my job to show people how to do it gracefully. You know, I don't know if that's what my job is or not, but that's what she tells me to do, so that's what I try to do, you know, do it gracefully. When I was a year sober, I lost custody of my kids. It was devastating. I was sober, and I lost custody of my kids. I've seen people who were heroin addicts get their kids back. You know, it's like, still on methadone plans, treatment and getting their kids back. I didn't understand it. Lost my kids. And then shortly after that, I came down with a very serious heart ailment, and they told me I would be dead or need a heart transplant within 5 years, that I would never work again. Because of the part of my heart it damaged, it wasn't a cholesterol kind of thing, it was a totally different deal. I didn't get enough oxygenated blood to my brain, so I had a lot of memory loss. I had to relearn how to drive, I had to relearn how to read, I had to relearn how to write, I had to relearn mathematics. So I'm not the same person that I used to be, but they still remember who that person was. And it's a constant reminder to accept who I am now, that this must be where I can do the best work. That's what I tell myself. I work a full-time job lugging paint cans around, and in 1994 they told me I'd be dead by 1999. And, you know, we just don't ever know what's going to happen. And I was able to sponsor so many women during that time from my bed with a telephone. I would go out once a day for a meeting after I got sick, and my husband would take me to meetings. And I met him in AA, and he's still sober also. But I think I mentioned that. Did I mention we were dating before we were both divorced, while we were still married to other people? We were actually engaged while we were still married to other people? Not a good example to follow. But, you know, I'm human. So, but, you know, I was able to answer the overnight hotline one night a week for years, 4 or 5 years, I answered the overnight hotline in Detroit. You know, it was something I could do from my bed. I managed a sober social center a few blocks from our house in Detroit. I was telling Eric and Dave about it before the meeting. When I got sober, I was going to meetings in Grosse Pointe and only lived a few blocks from Detroit. And there was a place called the Cookie Road Social Center. And they were Akron-style AA. Cleveland-style Newburgh. Norm Alpe, anybody know Norm Alpe? Norm Alpe-style AA. And they were serious about recovery, but they didn't take themselves too seriously. And I was told, don't go over there. Those people are fanatics. They're big book thumpers. You don't go anywhere near them. And so, of course, I snuck over there. And here we go, master manipulation. And I didn't quit going. Yeah, I walked in the door, and Harvey Johnson reached out his hand to me. Welcome, Cookie Road Holt Social Center. You look like a real alcoholic to me. I'm like, oh, excuse me, you know. Kind of took a little umbrage to that. I've probably been sober about 6 months, not very long. And then I thought, yeah, I am a real alcoholic. I do belong here. And that's when I really got into the book and started to understand that this is about the steps and how we live and being of service to other people. You know, the social center was open every evening from 6 until 10. It was a sober place. It was open to anybody who wanted to be there. Meeting was from 8 to 9. Each meeting had its own format, and then from 9 to 10 was another social hour. And it was a wonderful place for people in the community to go that was safe. Most of the, in Detroit, the most dangerous places are the fringe areas. Anywhere where it borders on a drastically different socioeconomic or ethnic area, that's where it seems to be the most dangerous. And that was a fabulous opportunity to be able to operate that place from my bed, because all I had to do was make sure that there were coffee makers, you know, and it was a short coffee maker commitment there. You only had to be a coffee maker for a year, not two, like at the Newberg Group. We started driving to Cleveland almost every Friday night for the Newberg Group, and that was a blast. And I'm a Dr. Bob guy, more than a Bill Wilson guy, I guess. I love Bill to death, but I always related to Dr. Bob better. You know, it was about the action and about how we're living every day and getting people through the steps, getting them through the work so they can get rid of that horrible pit of anxiety so they can start to find that there is something to live for. If I stay in that horrible, you know, no alcohol but no recovery place, I'm just going to want to shrivel up and die, and it's not going to, life isn't going to look like anything that I want to stick around for at all. You know, I've bounced around here a little bit. I'm sorry. Ninth step is really crucial for me. It was the thing that made me realize how much forgiveness I needed to do, not only of others, but of myself. And, you know, others first, obviously. That was most important. And my sponsor, again, you know, she had me do the toughest one first, the one that I didn't want to do. She had me, after we went through my fifth step, she then had me, you know, make my list, my eighth-step list, and then she had me take each person on my list or each institution and write an index card for that person and what the harm was and then what I thought I should do for the amends, and then we discussed what she thought I should do for the amends, and we sorted them in piles of things to do when the opportunity presented themselves, things that I should actively seek out to do, and things that if I did, I would cause more harm, so I'd better not do it, just learn to live with it, honey. And then the never pile. And there was one card in the never pile, and it was my father. And he was the sexual abuser of my kids. And I didn't want to make amends to my father. I didn't see where I owed him any amends. And she had said to me when we were doing the going over the resentments and stuff, and I said, well, you know, this is what he did. And she says, when was the last time you sent your dad a birthday card? When was the last, you know, and she said, does your father have any other daughters? No. So you took his only daughter away from him. I had to look at that. She said, are you willing just to think of him as a sick person? And the minute she said that, I was able to think of him as a sick person and not hate him so much. And it took a few years, but I was finally able to get to the place, and the thing that really pushed it was when I went to make amends to my mother and talked to her, and then when I said, you know, what do you want me to do to set this straight? And, you know, oftentimes people get confused about this amends thing, at least to my understanding, is that we're supposed to ask them what we need to do to make restitution. We can offer a solution, but we need to ask them, is there anything else I need to be doing? Is there anything else you need to say to me? And the one thing my mother said to me, she said, I want you to have a relationship with your father. That's what she wanted me to do to make amends to her, because it destroyed her that, you know, that I would not have anything to do with him. And that, and what I discovered, the capacity of the human heart is extraordinary when only willing to walk with God. I was able to have a relationship with my father for the last several years. And, you know, when he died about a year and a half ago, and it was bittersweet. There was, honestly, there was a tremendous amount of relief. There was a tremendous relief. But there was a grief that I had never imagined that there would have been. And I am so glad that I had that grief, because I didn't want to have that bitter joy. That's just not healthy. And I know if I hadn't worked through that forgiveness stuff with him, that I would never have had that kind of grief. And you know, don't shy from your amends. You know, yeah, they're hard. They're not what I want to do, but it's not about me. It's just not about me. And, you know, to continue on this path and, you know, I kind of, Stacy always talked about this kind of Blues Brothers mentality, you know, go to the most sordid place on earth, you know, we will be unharmed. You know, I would go to some pretty interesting neighborhoods in Detroit to pick people up, places where there were buckets coming down on strings from second floors where people put money in and the bucket would come up and buckets come down, and, you know, four or five burned out houses on a block or more, and just to pick up women to go to meetings. And I never gave it a thought. I'll go anywhere Alcoholics Anonymous asked me to go. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It gave me a life. It gave me a reason to live. I have never been without a sponsor, and I can't even though I haven't had great luck with sponsors staying sober, however. Stacy decided a few years ago that she wasn't an alcoholic, but she'd overreacted and at 19 years drank again, and she has now been sober since December 26th of 08. So she is sober again. And, you know, that's really challenged. It has challenged me in remembering, you know, and I've read it over and over, you know, our reliance is upon God, not upon humans. You know, we have an interdependence with humans, but our reliance has to be on God. And there's nothing like your sponsor drinking to remind you that your dependence had better be on God. You know, a sponsor can guide me. And both of my sponsors, whether they drank again or not, did not take away what they gave me. They taught me how to find a God of my own understanding that I could rely on. I have a wonderful sponsor here in Pennsylvania I absolutely love. I was hoping she was going to be able to be here tonight, but I figured she probably would be with the weather. And she has taken me places in my inventory that I never thought possible. I thought I've done inventory in every way possible, and I am here to tell you it gets more and more exciting every time I do an inventory. It's not exciting like Roller Coaster Journey Park exciting, but it's exciting in that I get to continue to figure out what else I can fix, you know, what else I can recognize that where I'm making myself, where I see, and I continually find these levels of fear. I'm continually peeling away these levels of fear. And the most revealing inventory to me, so I think my seventh year probably would have been my seventh or eighth inventory with Stacy, and I realized that I had been viewing the whole world from this place that I took up too much space on the planet. I was constantly thinking I took up too much space. And if you're approaching life from that viewpoint, you know, how can you be anybody except afraid? You know, and that took a long time for me to learn how to find my voice and how to do it politely. Made a lot of mistakes. I have a tendency to kind of go to one extreme to another, but I guess most of us probably do in one way or another. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. I know that a lot of people struggle with AA. I know that a lot of people come and go. I am so grateful that that has not been my story. I came and I stayed, and that's one of the things that Stacy always said. When people say, keep coming back, she'd always poke me and she'd say, just stay, it's a lot easier. Just stay, it's a lot easier. You know, she always had a lot of little rules and things for me, and a lot of people would say, well, that's not really in the book. I said, yeah, but I did hand myself over to my sponsor, you know, and I'll do what she asked me to do, you know, as long as it's not unreasonable. And I would even wear orange socks if she asked me to. But, you know, she would always, you know, if somebody's looking for a coffee maker, she'll do it. You know, we need to see, oh, she'll do it. You know, it's always, you know, somebody needs a sponsor, she'll do it. And, you know, that was great. And because I could never have volunteered for those things, she just kept pushing me into the middle, And she kept saying, you know, if you want to do this, you may as well want it all. Do you want the whole pie or you want just a piece? And I wanted the whole pie. I always have wanted all of whatever. So why not all of this? And it's an incredible freedom. It just keeps getting more and more amazing. And I love that it doesn't get stale. I love that still, every time I read this, I still find something new. It means something different to me every time. I just find it absolutely extraordinary. And I do. And I'm just repeating myself, and I'm so thrilled to be here. And thank you so much, Eric, for asking me to speak. Thank you.
Thank you.